presentation.
Well, the true question is, do you know what makes a good soldier, Connor?
Beans.
That question gets asked several times in this episode.
Yeah, but it's answered in a very singular way.
It's like you found my secret weak spot. Like I'm sort of villain, some villain you've been trying to defeat, and you're just like, this is the one thing.
It's the ability to fire three rounds in under 1 minute in any weather.
Yes.
Now that learn lessons all the time.
Have we started?
Yes.
Is this how you guys? Yeah. Is this how you guys do?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. We just start talking.
The thing is, Matt remembers lines, and I remember...
guns.
Yeah, guns.
yeah.
And, you know, he stumped me the last time, and I'm sure he'll stump me for the remaining, 20 of these?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're only feature-length episodes. Yeah. For anybody who is unaware, who didn't read the title, we are finally entering the second of the Sharp series, Sharp's Eagle. And as promised, we have brought in a guest, someone who's never seen any of the Sharps before, and I don't even know if he has any context for this, but Frank, how did you enjoy Sharps?
It was wonderful. I loved it. It was so great. I'll say, hi guys, I'm Frank from No Flicks Given. glad to be here. I didn't know what this was. I had a vague sense of like the time, like that it existed, that it was the time period it took place in, and like, when it was filmed. Like I had a kind of guess of what I knew what I was kind of going into, but I didn't know the characters or the plot really.
The ripples of its cultural legacy had sort of washed over you. At least at one point.
If that's how you want to word that, I did not know
Without Sharp, Sean Bean does not end up in Lord of the Rings or even really GoldenEye for that.
No, I was going to say GoldenEye. Yeah. Which is my first note of the that I took was 006 versus 007 again.
it's insane. I've seen this 3 times now and didn't clock it, knowing full well the two characters that those guys play.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. It's just because it wasn't something that crossed my mind. So, baby Daniel Craig from 1993. I don't even know how old he was in this, like 20-something probably at this point. And in the phase of his career where he's just playing shit-stained characters like this, and then like Road to Perdition and a couple other things where he's just a terrible person.
There's Road to Perdition was a long time after this.
I mean,
he's right. There is an era where he just played villains for a long time. And there was a movie I saw in school that he played like a neo-Nazi in Africa
that scans.
I have to find the, to find the name of it.
Especially when he's young. I mean, he aged into being handsome. He's ugly in Sharp's Eagle, but like he is definitely like a rat faced fuck. You know, he just gives off the vibes of don't being alone in a room with this guy.
Yeah, that's very fair. So, synopsis for anybody who didn't watch along. Sharp's Eagle takes place not too long after Sharp's Rifles. We've gotten the band back together where Sharp has been attached to the South Essex Regiment, which is going to be responsible for blowing up a bridge, a very small job for the regiment's very small man who is there solely because he bought the regiment and is just looking to find glory. And as you can imagine, hilarity ensues. People die. It's the Napoleonic Wars. War is bad. Gentlemen also very bad. Lowborn, up through the ranks guys, very good. Also Irish Catholics.
Yep. The working class Irish Catholic soldier. That when I forget if it's Brian Cox or if it's...
I think it's Brian Cox. You're talking about where he talks about the Irish fight. Yeah, where would the
English
be?
Where would the English be if not for the Irish? That scene where it's Brian Cox's character and Sharp and Harper. And,
Harper, yeah.
Yeah, and it's three of them talking, and you know, Harper is certainly Irish, and I guess Brian Cox's character, Major Hogan, is implied.
He is supposed to be Irish. Yeah.
And they're just talking about how awesome the Irish are and how much it sucks that they're stuck in the British Empire. And the fact that everything good that's happened in the British Empire has been because an Irish person has been involved. But his delivery of his conversation with Wellington, and I'm not even going to try to replicate the patter that he does with them.
Wellesley's worried about you. That fella Sharp, Hogan. Fella that saved my life. Fella still alive, Hogan. Alive and kicking, sir, says I. Quick at the repartee. Damn his impertinence. Don't he know there's a war on? He wants promotion, sir, says I. Again, quick at the repartee. He looks at me down his long nose. Hogan, says he. Hogan, tell Sharp that he'll never make captain, nursing his health.
Is possibly, this is going to be a controversial opinion, the best Brian Cox performance ever.
I mean, yeah.
So in Super Troopers, he's...
oh, no.
No, he's amazing in this. He's very... I got very strong Claude Rains in Casablanca vibes. A guy who is just so good at this world that he's like... kind of just fucking with everybody a little bit, but also is like, we'll make sure nothing goes wrong. Like he's just got a good finger on the scale of what needs to happen in the war without claiming any actual power, really.
Yeah. Well, it's the line of about Major Hogan's coat buttons up over a great many things.
So good. So good.
I'm going to struggle with all the names, by the way. Like
it's fine. Yeah. We'll figure it out. Which is, I guess, speaking of which, so Frank, had you, before Connor and I started just yakking back at each other about Sharp, had you any idea that this existed?
Yes, I had known it existed because it was just one of those ones that, like, I don't know, from just like, and I'm sure that you guys are the same way, where it's like just through the like mess of what we all YouTube as like movie fans and TV fans, like it just like eventually ends up in the algorithm. And you're like, huh, period piece, Sean Bean, early 90s. What is that? So I've seen like a clip or two, but not really. I've never dove in. I never really understood how many episodes there were or like what the context was. I knew a vague sense of like the time period and he's like the hero, but I didn't watch enough to really know his character. He's pretty basic of a character. He's just like heroic captain guy. Like he's just a soldier, really.
I had that exact origin story, Frank.
I
ran into,
I think we all did, yeah.
I ran into that the sharp YouTube people, like I guess it was a BritBox maybe that was like putting up all the stuff on Sharp on YouTube. They did an excellent job during the pandemic. Their timing was immaculate. Because my origin story is actually a scene from this exact episode, which is why I'm so excited that we're talking about this episode.
Wow.
It's which we'll get to later, because I want to make a bit of a meal out of that scene. But what I enjoyed so much was just really well-trained British actors in a room talking to each other. Because that's what the majority of the show is. Like, it has battles, but there's only so much battle budget. So a lot of it is just sort of like well-trained British actors portraying characters of varying levels of competency, having conversations about what needs to be done. And there is something about my approaching middle age white guyness, potentially never unlocked, but you know, resting dormant dad genes are about to, we're just like, This is what I need. This is what I need in my life right now. And
it is dime.
It is dime.
Makes you want to buy a painting of a ship.
I mean, in fairness, I have wanted to and begged Katie to let me do that for the last 10 years.
Matt doesn't have a table full of boats in bottles is astounding to me.
Ship in the bow. Oh, good Lord. Didn't anybody here build ships in bottles when they were boys?
I did not play with toys.
I think, Connor, you're right. And it has that, like, it's in that category of, like, a play done outside. It's got, you know, that's really the context of a lot of it. Like, the battle scenes are, like, honestly kind of wowed me with the, like, it's nothing amazing, but, like, it was bigger than I thought it was going to go. You know?
Yeah, they're very strategic with their use of the battle scenes. It reminds me of the old, like, when you would learn about Shakespeare, about the fact of, like, you have to, you can't show battles because we just don't, you can't do it. That's the limit of the medium. And in this case, it's budgetary, but, like, the idea of, like, yeah, we're going to have to stuff everything we can into characters speaking very well and in a very motivational way to get people fired up about the battle that they're not going to see. It's like the first season of Game of Thrones.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. With a lot of the same actors.
Yeah.
A decent amount. Like, I actually think it was brilliant. I think my favorite scene, I'm going to have a couple while we go through. I think my favorite right now is when he is training the green soldiers about what a battle is like. And he says, like, you're not going to see anything. It's going to be smoke everywhere. And then later in the final battle, they use smoke as a budgetary constraint. Mm-hmm. To really, like, only have a couple people on screen and make it seem like a giant battle is happening. It's really strategic.
It's well crafted. It's knowing the limits of what you've got to work with.
Sure.
And kind of using that to your advantage and then turning some of that into some of the better parts of the whole fucking thing.
Yeah.
Cause I mean, yeah, like that whole monologue where he's trying to train those poor South Essex boys.
Black powder blasting by the ton on all sides. Black smoke blinding you and choking you and making you vomit. And the French come out of the smoke. Not in a line, but in a column. And they march towards our thin line. Kettle drums hammering like hell. And a golden eagle blazing overhead.
And that's, I mean, we talked a little bit about this in the last episode, but that's what I love about Sharp. It's like every scene, especially with Sharp in it, has like the double layers of like what he's trying to accomplish in the moment and what he's trying to accomplish in like the larger sense of his like life and career.
I do want to know a little bit now about like, what is the overarching thing? Like what did I just watch? No.
Does
but like
it
what
feel
like,
well I guess well I'll I can answer the question, but I'm curious if this quote unquote episode, it's feature length, but does this episode on its own feel like its own 100%. Contained story? Okay.
Yeah.
Which is another miracle of this series. Like the fact that Frank can jump in, not having seen the first episode, but understand basically who everybody is and what they want to do and what the stakes are is amazing craft.
There's a bit in the beginning where you're a little like, okay, who's new in this episode and who was in episode one energy, which is just unavoidable.
There's
also like, he's injured when the episode starts. I'm like, okay, is that from the first episode or do we just go really? Okay. That was the one thing I was sure of was like the first episode ends with him injured.
No, it's over the course of the war, he's gotten beaten up. The opening of this episode has so much rom-com energy. It's hard to ignore. So we'll get to that because to preface this, the whole concept of Sharp, it's a series of books that were written by Bernard Cornwell. And then this was in the 80s. This was kind of the thing that he cut his teeth on. And at some point, ITV decided to make a series out of it. Richard Sharp is a sergeant, a dude who happens to save the future Duke of Wellington's life and gets promoted for that as a lieutenant, which did not happen then because at the time, officers would purchase their commissions. So the only men who were officers were gentlemen who had money already.
Was that episode one? He saves Wellington's life?
Yes. It's okay.
That's it's like the happens in the first like 5 minutes.
Yeah. And so most of the series is he's supposed to be like the audience insert character, like the regular guy thrust into this insane world of class. And I was very curious to remember the difference, because Connor and I also discussed this in the first episode, is that the tone has changed from the first episode already. The first episode is a little grittier. They had a little bit of a lower budget to shoot it with, because I think technically it was kind of a proving pilot. And it's getting the gang together. So those, the dudes in the green jackets, the chosen men, that's Sharp's gang. That's his guys. And in the first episode, everyone hates him and he hates them. And they spend a good portion of the first half of that episode trying to kill each other. Yeah. Not least of which Dara O'Malley's character.
Who's that? Harper. Is that his like second?
Yeah, that's Harper, his like sidekick with the curly hair.
His romantic interest.
His romantic interest.
Love that guy. That was great.
He's fucking great.
Oh yeah. No, he's and so to go from like when I was marathoning this a year ago, to go from that where it's like there's this grudging respect that they have with each other by the end, to like they are practically an old married couple in the opening scenes of this, is a little bit of a tone shift, but I was totally there for it. Of just like, yeah, it's fine now. They're a superhero gang. Yeah. It's cool. Well, yeah. Let's move on.
But also, again, it's that storytelling. It's that storytelling thing that they're doing where it's like, if you know the last episode, this is how much their relationship has progressed. You know, like
yeah.
They went from, you know, trying to kill each other to now Harper's nursing his wounds and trying to shave him.
Yes.
Really wants to shave that guy.
Really wants to shave that guy.
Which we've all, you can tell time we've all passed. Tried to shave each other. Like that's
exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and that,
ladies, that's what men.
That Jesus. That implies a history of them saving each other's lives and taking care of each other.
Mm-hmm.
Harper's growing respect to be like at Sharp's beck and call. One must assume that Sharp has saved Harper's life several times over. And also that also like taking care of him is like his job, but like, you know, I am always wowed by how, especially British television, is so economical with their storytelling. And sometimes it's like little magic tricks like that. And sometimes it's just the British villains being villains from the first frame that they're on screen.
Holy
and just
hell.
And laying out for all to see precisely the ways in which they're villainous.
Sir Henry fucking Simmerson.
You do not know the British soldier, sir. He is a brute beast in a red coat. He needs the lash. Whip him in, Mr. Barry.
Yeah, like Simmerson being a classist fuck. Daniel Craig's character being a fucking slime ball. The Virginian guy being really proud of how many slaves he used to have.
The Virginian guy is an interesting character, and we can discuss him later. But yeah, he's a weird one.
We need to
Leroy.
Leroy. We need to discuss him at length. I actually really like the way that they went about dealing with his character.
Very much so.
Can we discuss? Because I'm pretty sure he's a good guy in the end. As far as like the audience's orientation with him, like
he's an outsider. I think the thing is that because he's separated from the class structure of traditional England, he has more in common with Sharp than with the gentleman that he's with, just by virtue of the fact that he doesn't understand or seem to terribly care all that much about those rules.
Right. Well, because the rules of class are in America was and continues to be race. Like, you know, I like to use this as an example. The Office episode, like their Office episode that sort of racial sensitivity training.
The Diversity Day.
Diversity Day from the first season of The Office. The Diversity Day episode is based off the British Office's episode about class.
Huh.
Really?
It's that much of a divide in the UK as it is here. So you have sort of the double-edged sword of like, This guy, you know, relates more with Sharp because he is sort of, I don't want to say a self-made man because that implies too much, but like he is
slaves, a sort of like, cotton.
He's a slave-made man.
Yeah, he's a slave made man. But he's a guy who generated all of his value through just cold hard cash. I don't know what his actual backstory is, but like theoretically you could see it being like it has nothing to do with who his family is, how like the circumstances of how he was born. He was probably born into wealth here, but the thing that really divides him from his from underlings is race. And therefore he does not give a flying fuck about what he doesn't give a shit about the gentry. They are just as rich as he is. And that's what he values.
Do you guys recognize that actor?
The actor's name is what? Gavin O'Hara.
Gavin O'Hara. It's weirdly spelled, but
it's Irish.
Don't look it up. Do you know what else he was in?
I mean, I already know his technical claim to fame for everything else.
What's his tech? What does that mean?
He was Richie Cunningham's brother that appears for like three episodes in the beginning of Happy Days.
And
never mentions his brother again.
Guys,
what had you clocked him for, Frank?
Well, it's a movie where one of his eyes is fake. Does that ring any bells, Matt? From a series we just talked about.
Oh. Never Say Never Again.
Say Never Again. And
he's
at the
Largo?
Same time, he is the captain. He's the guy
who... I haven't
who,
seen this in so long.
He always stuck out to me because he's got that face with that terrible skin. Like he's just like very...
Well, yeah, he's got like the greasy freckled skin and the very, very, very fair hair. He looks like a slice of cheese pizza.
Yeah.
I say that with all love.
He looks like if Bill Burr went hard into plastic surgery, the best he could look. And he was also in Superman 3 is the other one. He's the like old high school bully from Smallville that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I knew that he was a pretty prolific working actor in that period of time, but yeah, the thing that I knew was that he was in Happy Days for a hot second.
That I didn't know. That's interesting.
And he's perfect for this part too. He reads so much. He reads so much like Virginia plantation asshole.
Oh God. Yeah.
But
he serves as this uneasy ally with Sharp solely by virtue of like, yes, race over class, but also I think there is something that Leroy sees in Sharp. Because Leroy, despite his money coming from slaves, cotton, and molasses, believes himself to be a self-made man and sees Sharp as a self-made man. And that's kind of like the glue that keeps them together initially, but is also very aware that Sharp will get people killed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he also, and this is a weird thing to put on a slave owner character, is the most of that group of, you know, of guys, the most aware of the border between right and wrong, like an objective point of view
of like non Sharps people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That was fun. That was what was confusing about him.
He has a well-defined like moral center. Again, for a slaveholder.
Yeah.
You
know,
other than Brian Cox and Wellington, who are kind of, these like Gandalfian characters that come in and out as needed.
Yeah. They're more Machiavellian, I think, though. Hogan.
Honestly, the arc of this episode/movie is Wellington and Hogan really want to get
Simerson
killed. Like that's what they're trying to accomplish. Like,
yeah, because they know he's a all hat and no cattle.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that I mean, from a purely practical perspective, like he's going to lose them the war. But as soon as there's a very specific scene where Hogan's like,
a general who wins battles and lives to claim the credit will never laugh for enemies in London, sir.
I have officers deserving commissions, notably William Lawford. And what am I sent? Flogged soldiers led by coffee house fops and commanded by dangerous buffoons.
Sir Henry Simerson on the South Essex.
Quite so. I suspect he's been sent to spy on me.
Well, why not give them something to send back that will spoil their lordship's supper?
And that's kind of the Machiavellian play of it all, of like, and we'll use Sharp because he's useful.
Right.
And like, they don't want to lose Sharp because he's useful, but like, it's not because they necessarily feel any particular warmth about him. It's just they see him as a tool in their broader game.
The right really, tool for this particular
game. I mean, I didn't see episode one, but I read that first scene is very like nefarious and pulling the strings a bit, but like, by the end of it, I was like, I think they're just sort of like playing all sides to make sure all the people that are like pure of heart benefit and all the people that are like, they continually like reward and build scenarios for like Sharp and his men to succeed and for like the other people to sort of fail. And like constantly, it's not just punishing Simerson and his like bully guys, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's also, I think, because within the moral universe of the Sharp stories, the people that are on the moral right side of the line are also good soldiers, which is something that I think the source material treats pretty straightforward. Like that's like that's the lesson. Like if you're like a righteous and honorable man, that's part of what being a good soldier is.
I do want to talk about the like the firing of the three shots in 1 minute piece, which becomes sort of such a staple to it. And when he's training them how to do it, it's a great scene. The subtle ways he's like, no, you can cheat this step by doing like hitting the butt of the gun and stuff. Like it's,
which by the way, that method is full of shit, but that's its own thing.
they actually did a test and it's not completely full of shit.
Okay.
It's,
well, have either of you fired that type of gun before?
A musket? No.
Any of those sort of single bullet, musket shot. So I have, and it's the idea of doing that three times in 1 minute is so superhumanly crazy. I mean, I feel like someone could do it, but like it's such a process. And then still to this day, that smell when you fire it is just like so disgusting. It's like being inside of a smoker's lung, and it immediately like fills the whole area with just the thickest of smoke.
That part I am familiar with because growing up in Virginia, I went to so many battlefields from so many wars to watch reenactors do that shit. There's just a lot of them.
There's a lot of great setup payoff like that. Cause like that's the first thing that he tells Simerson is that that's what makes a great soldier, and then goes on to teach Simerson's men how to do it and how to fight effectively. Because obviously Simerson thinks that, you know, just wrapping stocks around their necks and whipping them when they pass out from exhaustion is really the only way, because the British soldier's a brute.
And then they double down on that by making the guy that got whipped in the first scene good enough at being a soldier to join the chosen men.
The chosen men. Yeah.
Which
is that that guy at the end? I didn't make that connection.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's Dobbs, I think his name is.
What were you going to ask me?
No, I was just for context, the chosen men, the guys in green, are like Napoleonic era British Continental Army equivalent of the special forces.
Oh, I took them as like Marines. Like that how I was thinking about them, which is, that uniform is awesome. It's fucking awesome. Great. I wish I had that jacket.
And they were armed with rifles heading into Connor's gun corner. All of the weapons that the guys in red coats had, the regular infantry on both sides had, were muskets, which are smoothbore. And the ball that it fired didn't actually touch the walls of the or didn't perfectly like seat in the barrel, so it would bounce around in the barrel to begin with. So they were incredibly inaccurate. All the guys
that's the green, red coat guns.
Yeah, that's the red coat guns. All the guys in and green are given rifles, and the barrel is rifled, and the bullets actually touch the barrel on their way out, which gives the bullet spin.
The spin,
which makes them
yeah,
super accurate for the time.
I noticed that where the guns were just like, they're also just like massive, huge, like looking like Looney Tunes style Elmer Fudd hunting guns.
Yeah. And the tactic with those guys is exactly what happens in the end battle. They would go off to the side and start shooting at the enemy infantry from hidden locations. And the objective of war during the Napoleonic War was basically the first side that runs away loses. And so they would basically kill enough people and create enough confusion that to inspire the enemy force to drop their shit and run away.
Yeah. And all of this, it goes back into Sharp's speech of talking about it, of like, you're going to see French soldiers and they're going to keep walking and it's going to take them being volleyed at 3 full times in a minute, 6 whole times in 2 minutes before they even think about turning back.
I did like that he knew 6 total shots would do it.
Oh yeah.
That's cool.
Mean, and it establishes him as a veteran without him saying like, I've fought in 1800 battles and blah, 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 blah. It's like, no, he's teaching guys how to do things because he's seen how this shit works, which is, it's an interesting, and the other interesting thing that you don't really get to see a lot of it in this side, but that the French didn't use rifle units. Mm-mm. They relied more on cavalry and scaring the shit out of guys that way. So it was all, yeah, like kind
of just sheer numbers of people.
To Connor's point, a lot of it, especially this period of time, it's mostly just about breaking the morale of the guys that are there to cede the ground that you're on. And that's pretty much that. It's definitely interesting as a concept. It's horrifying in practice.
Which brings me to my next point of that this movie makes the Napoleonic War seem like a gigantic game of capture the flag.
You've lost the colors.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to talk about this because there was like a 25-minute stretch of this movie where they kept saying eagle and I did not know what that meant. And I was like,
did you learn through the context of the film what the eagle is and what it means?
Well, by the end of the movie.
Okay. No, I did. Then the movie,
but there's
did
a
job.
Stretch where the Sir Barristan Selmy guy dies.
Major Lennox,
great character, great sort of like
soldier.
Yeah. He dies and he's like, hey, you have to bury me with an eagle. And I'm like, cool. I don't know what that means. And then they're like, no, you know what it means. We're moving on. I'm like, okay, I don't know what that means. They're like, no, trust us. You know what that means. We're going to just go forward and not explain it.
There's a lot of that where it sets up little things that they don't explicitly explain to you that, like, hopefully over the course of the whole story you pick up on.
By the end, I'm clear on everything except the difference between the two women. That was the only thing that I just could not
oh
get.
Yeah, that would be the one element that would be, yeah,
hot damn, man.
I can see that being complicated. I also feel like that's one of those things where if you grew up in the British education system, that you would just kind of know. It's just sort of,
yeah, you would
in
know
the air.
Yeah, and the romantic interest stuff gets muddied because Lost in Adaptation is the book takes place before Sharp meets the woman that he ends up with in the end of this movie. Oh. So like in the book version, he ends up sleeping with, what was it, Josefina, I think is the name of the lady, because Teresa hasn't shown up yet. So they had to kind of flummox that entire arc, and like it does make things a little bit clunky because like otherwise Teresa wouldn't have even been in the episode.
It does have an interesting bit of tension to that relationship though, because it's sort of like you think she's
they haven't completely like come together until the very end.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's sort of a moment where like Teresa's like, if you want to fuck her, that's fine.
Which one is, I don't, which one has pants? I don't know the difference.
Teresa's she's the one with pants. She's the gorilla. She's the Spanish gorilla.
Yes.
And then Josefina is the lady. She's the one who's always in a dress and has
who's
the
not
money
good
problems.
At paying her. Yeah.
Well, cause she has money problems and that creates a whole other to do.
And why are they all in Spain? I don't.
Okay. This would be another thing that you would pick up if you were in British schooling and all this other stuff about the Napoleonic Wars. It does explain it in the Star Wars like crawl in the opening. Did you read that?
Yes, no, I got that. Don't take that tone with me. But I I got it. And I do know that like for all intents and purposes, the Napoleonic War should be considered like World War Zero. It was a world war in any sense of the word.
Yes. Like,
but as far as like what the confusion of that opening crawl, I'm just going to keep going, was it says Napoleon's brother is now the king.
Napoleon is master of Europe. Yes.
Is that identical? Does it say it in both?
Yes. Okay, it's in that. No. So that, so this is the other thing too, is that master and commander and sharp are sides of the same coin.
Yes. Yes.
So yes, Napoleon at this point had controlled most of Western Europe and usurped his most Catholic Majesty, King Philip of Spain.
He installed his brother as the King of Spain.
As the puppet, yeah.
Yes.
So Spain was part of the French Empire at that point. And so the British were helping Spanish guerrillas who wanted to throw out Napoleon's brother win and then work their way back into France. So that's why most of Sharp takes place in Spain. If you ever hear about the Peninsula War, the Peninsula Campaign, that's what they're talking about, is Spain was the battleground of most of this war.
Okay, very cool. That's a crazy chunk. Can I spoil some? Is the final episode Waterloo? Is that what?
Yes. The final episode of the original run, yes. And then they made two more, which they should never have done.
But they made Waterloo.
10 years later.
They do Waterloo.
Okay. Yeah.
Is Sharp at Waterloo?
Yes. Sharp is at Waterloo.
Does he get an eagle?
Not anymore. No. He keeps, Stephen, the doctor for Master and Commander, from making an ass of himself, because he's the Prince of Orange in that episode.
Paul Bettany's in it?
Wow. Paul Bettany's in it, baby. This is the thing. Over the course of the series, every British actor appears.
It was the Game of Thrones of its time.
It's the whole story is essentially a game of capture the flag, and it's mostly about honor and duty and respecting.
It's about actually living your values as opposed to just spouting off about them.
Correct. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And I think it does a pretty good job hitting on those pretty standard romanticized themes without overselling them. And also without dulling the horrors of war a bit.
Yeah. Like one of the things that I really admire the Sharp series for, and I've only watched these two all the way through, is the way that they, can both be like, yes, this particular battle was about capturing the other side's flag in this like weird game that Europe was playing with people's lives, but also be like, and it was also fucking horrific. Like there's like there is certainly honor in doing your duty, but also it's stupid. It's real. I mean, that might be me projecting. I don't know if that's me.
I think the character that represents that particular point in this is Ensign Denny, the boy officer who didn't realize who Major Lennox was when he died, and then starts to really buy into everything Sharp has to say, and then ultimately is killed in the final battle.
Yeah, that's another moment with Leroy where it's like, I don't know how I feel so many different things about this guy.
I think that's what makes him an intriguing character. But yeah, there is that moment I don't think that they're necessarily friends by the end of the story, especially considering the fact that he's very of the, like he even says merit walks, money talks. Like that's his whole thing. So like there's no point in getting yourself killed over an eagle or honor or duty or dueling or any of that sort of stuff.
And from Leroy's point of view, there's no point in getting other people killed. At least that's implied, which is interesting, again, coming from that fucking guy.
Yeah, well, like, we're talking about white people, so that's why.
Fair,
yeah.
Fair.
Can I ask, because the way I interpreted a lot of his part in the last chunk of this was he thinks Sharp with the whole eagle thing is like, that's stupid, like it's not worth going for. When Sharp does go for it, it's like a thing. You'll get yourself killed trying to do that, basically, is like, or you'll get other people killed. When he does it and claims it, he goes to like, not really confront him while he's like injured in it, like at the, after the battle, and is like,
Why?
I wanted to become firm captain. I needed an eagle to be certain.
And then the implication is at the end, tell me if I'm wrong about all this. At the end, when he's like at Lennox's grave and plants the flag, there's a shot of Leroy observing this and realizes that Sharp actually had like good reasons, like, you know,
honorable
deeper
reasons.
Yeah. Honorable reasons to do that. Is that what I was supposed to get from all of that?
I think so for the most part, because I think the point as far as the letter of the law for the army in this particular scenario is trying to capture the eagle is a stupid thing. But
yes,
as with a lot of military traditional bullshit, the spirit of the law is, well, if you get it though, we're going to love you for it.
Yeah.
And so there's the twofold thing of like, even of Wellington even saying when he promotes Sharp, he's like, if you promised to go steal this thing, I'm taking away that promotion. But then once Sharp gets the eagle in the end anyway and does like whatever, it's like, all right, well, good on him. Like, he's a really good soldier, you know?
Yeah.
And it's the dichotomy of those two concepts living in the same space.
Yeah. And some of that too is speaking Leroy's language, because he got the eagle for both reasons. Like, he needed to get the eagle to cement his captain position. He also went and got the eagle because he promised a dying man that he would. And because what Sharp says to him after he says,
young Denny, dead, all the others, all that blood. For an eagle,
slaves, cotton and molasses, you said. Slaves bleed. All that black blood to fill a purse, sir.
Oh, yeah. Which felt a little bit sort of like author insert making a point, but I certainly felt the catharsis of it. I think part of it is sort of some of the like the inbuilt loathing that Sharp seems to feel for Leroy, just because of who he is.
Yeah, but I also think that there's an understanding between the two of them too, of because neither of them are gentlemen traditionally, conventionally, they need to use other means to cement their position in this society. Yeah. And part of that for Sharp is grabbing this stupid eagle, not least of which everything that it stands for, because it, kind of what we were talking about in the way that these battles were fought is that a lot of it has to do with morale and which way things are feeling, and ultimately capture the flag comes from that.
Yeah. And also like it sort of goes back to like one of the main themes of Sharp, of like, this is all stupid and for nothing, and a game played by the rich using the poor, but also it's deadly serious.
Yeah. Well, I'm realizing now like how little the French, I know the French are generally portrayed more as like, at least in this episode, a little more of a force of nature, especially the like drumming march. Is that the point, that this war is pointless? Or it feels like one of the few wars where you're like, no, we kind of do have to fight this one. Like, it doesn't feel like an actual, Napoleon's conquering everything. Like, Napoleon is just like actually destroying. It's like, it's
some
like
might say he's master of Europe.
Okay. But it's one of those ones where, is that the theme? Because I did not get that, like, war is pointless is one of the themes to this. It's more like war is the backdrop.
I think it's less that war is pointless in the Napoleonic War in particular. I mean, war is, to a pretty severe degree, just sort of in general, pretty pointless. But the Napoleonic Wars in particular were pointless. It was, I think a lot of it is that the way that it was being conducted was about silly shit.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, the entire, like, it's like the entire premise that sets up having to steal the eagle is because the regiment that these guys are serving in is run by a complete toff.
Yeah. And also, they lost their flag. Some cloth. Who fucking cares?
But it was touched by the king himself, yeah. Connor.
So it's not that the... It's not that the war is stupid. It's that everything surrounding the war is stupid. The fact, the societal structure that allowed the war to happen in the first place is stupid, because you have the strata of the people, of the high class people that are making all the decisions, and the low class people that have to go fight and die for it. And there's another sort of level to it, where it's like all of the British soldiers are professionals. Like, that's their job. Being a soldier is their job. Like, that's why Sharp wants to get promoted, because that's his job. All of the French soldiers are conscripts.
Yeah.
They were just pulled out of the lowest ranks of French society, said you have to go fight and die in this war, which is how Napoleon was so successful, just because he had so many fucking people he could throw at any given problem.
Yeah. I think the flag thing, and again, like, this is the only time the flag on a battlefield I've ever seen it be a plot point or any sort of goal. I might have been doing too much like legwork with it, where I took that as, once they started making a big deal out of it, especially when the British one got taken, my mind was like, yes, taking the flag that's cloth is stupid and caring about it is stupid. But the idea of it is, where the flag is placed on a battlefield within an army, and the way armies sort of like will break and fall back and things like that, the way these battles were fought, the super lack of likeliness that an enemy soldier would get anywhere near your flag means that, like, you fucked up so badly. Yeah. Like it is insane that it's even possible to do that. Stealing of the flag doesn't really matter. It's more like you fucked up the rules of battle so bad that, like, an almost impossible thing, the enemy was able to accomplish an almost impossible task. And
oh yeah, I'm afraid Major Hogan saves the worst for the last.
Yeah, well, and that's again sort of, I mean, I'm sort of harping on this idea, but I think it's worth harping on. It's sort of like that practical reality that you talked about, Frank. Like, that's a thing that we would think about, and like that, and that's the deadly serious side of the war,
right?
You know, but again, you go back into the office and it's like, well, that flag was touched by the king. That's the king's flag.
Yeah.
Somebody stole the king's flag. That's unacceptable. You have dishonored yourself, sir. Which.
Yeah, you're right.
I think leads us into, Matt,
the scene.
The scene. The scene that. The money shot of Sharp. The scene that birthed this very series that we are on now.
Do you know what scene you're talking about?
You know what scene we're talking about, Frank?
No.
Scene where Lord Simerson is getting his ass dressed down by Lord Wellington.
The fault was not mine, sir. Major Lennox must answer. Major Lennox answer with his life, as you should have done if you had any sense of honor. You lost the colors of the King of England. You disgraced us, sir. You shamed us, sir. You will answer.
Yeah, so after he fucks up blowing up the bridge...
Yeah.
Simerson has to report back to Wellington and give his report of what happens. And then there's just this amazing British off of a scene between these two actors, where everybody else in the scene is just kind of like looking at each other. But there's just the way that they conduct this particular, whatever, 3 to 5 minutes, to me, is more compelling than any of the battles that appear in this entire series.
I recommend Lieutenant Gibbons be gazetted captain, sir.
And Lieutenant Sharp?
Lieutenant Sharp Divot, sir. He was cut off when we destroyed the bridge.
This is a report from Major Hogan, which differs somewhat from your account, Sir Henry.
Major Hogan is merely an engineer, sir.
Major Hogan's coat buttons up tight over a number of other duties, Sir Henry.
And this is—it's notoriously—it's the if you go to YouTube and type in Major Lennox, this is the thing that shows up. Or if you type in Sharp, this is going to be one of the first three videos that shows up.
Okay,
it is the core of what this whole show is about. it's British actors being British actors about the Napoleonic Wars.
Mm-hmm.
Talking yeah, about right. honor and duty and disgrace. And the thing that I think I particularly enjoy about it is it's dressing down a martinet gentleman who bought his commission mm-hmm. and raising up the guy that we know from the ranks who's our man Sharp.
A truly hateable commander.
Like he is an antagonist over the course of the series. He shows up again.
You know, oh, he's in more. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, he's too good of a villain to not show up again.
You know what this scene... when I first saw this scene, this hadn't happened yet, but you know what this scene feels a lot like?
Mm.
It feels like Donald Trump getting yelled at by a judge in court.
Oh, yeah.
A fundamentally same silly person takes themselves hair. Way too seriously and is way too... overconvinced of their own abilities and skill based on where the being born on third, thinking they hit a triple.
Yep.
Being suddenly confronted by the most serious person on the planet who
has actual authority,
yeah. takes their job very seriously, understands the stakes of what they're doing and explains to them on no uncertain terms that they have fucked up. That's a serious problem. And there's no getting out of it. Like mm-hmm. that scene where he approaches the desk and says,
I have a cousin at Horse Guard, sir. And I have friends at court. A man who loses the king's colors loses the king's friendship. You have two choices. To hide in England or be a hero in Spain. I shall help you to be a hero. We had a skirmish with the French today. Tomorrow we shall have a battle. You will be the first to see a French column, sir. It is not a pretty sight. What you do then, sir, is up to you. Good morning.
You know, and like the complete defeat of Simmerson in that scene is so fucking cathartic, having seen the movie all the way through for the first time. And in that scene, in isolation, is just a masterclass of British acting. Of just sort of like variations of tone, understanding what the story you're telling is, how to deliver the lines to the best effect to land the story that you're telling, and also an amazing prosthetic nose.
Oh my God.
All right, we're going to talk about the nose, right?
Yeah. Poor David Troughton. Other actors end up playing Wellington over the course of the series. They all have to deal with the prosthetic nose.
Yeah. Well, so I don't know a ton about this era. I did not know that Wellington's real name was Wellesley. Wellesley?
Sir, or Lord Arthur Wellesley, yeah.
Arthur Wellesley. So they said that, and I was like, okay. They said it like I should know what that is, but it's not clicking. And then he's got this fucking gonzo schnoz, and I'm like, okay, that's added. This is supposed to be, it'd be like someone adding makeup features to look like George Washington. You're like, well, you're not, this is a person I'm supposed to connect with. Like I'm supposed to get.
But if you're, you know, Norwegian British, yeah. and you're watching The Patriot and you see this guy in the background of a scene with this giant honker of a nose, you're like, I know he's a general, but I don't know why they had to put all that bullshit on his face.
Yeah.
I think we're having that same reaction as Americans.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
everybody knows in England who the Duke of Wellington is.
I mean, yeah, I know. If they had said, they might have even said the Duke of Wellington early on, but like connecting that together.
The reason why is because he doesn't become the Duke of Wellington
until the
battle is won at the end of the episode.
Yeah, that was like the Dark Knight Rises. Oh, you should use your middle name, Robin. You're like, okay. It's an origin story,
but again, that's the class commentary thing, because he wasn't given peerage until this point in the war, you know.
Yeah.
Which gives him that perspective that's again more serious and not like, I paid for this, why am I not having fun on my vacation?
Yeah, it's insane. The more I watch this, and you see it in other episodes too, of just the way that Simmerson treats the entire regiment as a toy that he's bought for himself.
Well, the
and it's
75
astounding.
Lashes. I want to mention that, and I was like, I don't know enough about corporal punishment, but that feels like too many. Like, shouldn't that kill you? Like, that's so much bleeding.
Depending on the type of whip, potentially.
Yeah, it did not kill people back then.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a crazy amount. Three is like you did something real bad. Yeah.
Well, and one of the other things that it's not as necessarily obvious, but all of the collars. Yeah. Which was a real thing for training and historically used to guard your neck against knives and swords. But like the idea of him doing it solely because he wants them all to look in a very specific way, despite the fact that it gives them all rashes.
Yes. It's also, it's convenient and a little cheesy, but the, you can't fire three shots in a minute until I get you to take those collars off piece. Yeah. And like I'm unshackling. It's very on the nose. But yeah, it's really effective as far as like really quickly establishing like the power dynamics between Sharp and Simmerson.
Simmerson, yeah. And Sharp, stop showing off.
Incredibly satisfying too.
Oh God.
Very satisfying. Sharp's great. He's extremely for a, and I don't know what the other movies, I'm just going to keep calling them movies because that's how Letterboxd identifies them. But this kept sort of like kind of flirting with like, is Sharp's ambition a cautionary tale? And I couldn't really, it seems like no in this episode, but it did flirt with that a little bit with like, is he just trying to rise up the ranks and doesn't really care?
It's a mixed bag. Cause he's, yeah. I mean, it's as far as the story is concerned, he's the son of a Yorkshire prostitute who doesn't know his father, who came from nothing, joined the army because it was going to pay. And why are you laughing?
I don't know. My brain was like, son of a Yorkshire prostitute who doesn't know his mother. And
I mean, that did happen too in this era. That wasn't
sorry. Keep going.
Orphanages are things.
Yeah. And, but this whole idea of like this, the him rising through the ranks is being promoted at your job. And so it is important to try to raise your station, not just for the honor and the glory and the competency, but just to just get more money so that you can go home in a better place than you left it.
Yeah.
And that's very much a theme throughout the course of the series.
Yeah. Literally his only chance at a decent life is getting promoted and to a point that he might actually have savings.
It's comfort food. This was comfort food, really.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what the Major Lennox scene was for me when I first saw it and why I wanted to do this series.
It's comfort food, but it has themes and lessons, and I think that it does have something to say ultimately. But it does it in a way that's entertaining and compelling, which is really like that's the best way to produce your art.
And like, I do love any time an army has to blow up a bridge. I don't know. I'm a sucker for it. Oh man. Come on. That is just cinema.
I guess the final note that I do want to make sure that we cover is he gets his mission from from Hogan in that wonderful scene where he's like, do you know anything about art? And then unfurls the map. And he's like,
oh yeah, Botticelli. Like,
Sharp's like, what the fuck is this? He's like, it's a map of Spain. It's upside down. Ha ha.
Oh, that was great.
And he like gives him the mission. He's like, you're going to go here and you're going to blow up this bridge. And in my mind, I'm like, all right, you got to blow up a bridge. Probably a big fucking bridge. And then they get there and it's like literally, it's a few, it's like some toothpicks over a creek.
Bridge.
Yeah. So here's another note is that one of the major differences from the novel is that the bridge that they're supposed to blow up is actually an old Roman bridge. And so it's a much more formidable thing
made out of
in the novel.
Concrete.
Yes. Yeah. But again, we're shooting in Crimea in 1993. So like you make do with what you got.
That would have been cool. It's like how the Battle of Stirling Bridge in Braveheart does not even have a river.
There's a lot wrong with Braveheart.
It's really just that one thing.
chance of with his life, as you should have done if you had any sense of honor.